Today is Wednesday, April 31st. This is, oh, no, it is May 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Venezuela's opposition launches a major effort to oust embattled President Nicolas Maduro.
We want, as our principal objective, the peaceful transfer of power. But I will say again, as the president has said from the outset, all options are on the table.
New developments in the issue of transparency from the U.S. Attorney General over the special counsel's Russia report. Also ahead, the Trump administration wants asylum seekers to pay a fee to apply. It's all on today's International Edition. Thousands of demonstrators took to the streets of the capital of Venezuela, with gunfire erupting and troops loyal to Maduro firing water cannons at protesters. One Venezuelan National Guard vehicle running over demonstrators who were throwing rocks at the military. It follows Venezuelan opposition leader taking to the streets with activist Leopoldo Lopez and a small contingent of heavily armed soldiers early Tuesday in a bold call for the military to rise up and oust socialist leader Nicolas Maduro from power. As the White House watches closely, National Security Advisor John Bolton described the unfolding drama as a very serious situation and called on top Venezuelan officials, including the defense minister, to convince military commanders to defect to Guaido.
We know that over 40 people have been killed by the Maduro regime in the course of these protests. This is an act of bravery by Guaido and others. Really for the freedom of the Venezuelan people.
Well, joining us now to talk more about it is Emmanuel Iatolungue, senior fellow with the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Is this likely to get worse before it gets better?
Listen, I mean, for the last 5 months, President Guaido has been a thorn on the side of the Maduro regime, despite the fact that he has, you know, little control of anything of the powers of state, not the army, not the bureaucracy by and large. And so, you know, the fact that it hasn't immediately panned out with Maduro leaving the country and the army en masse defecting to Guaido does not mean that this does not have a chance of success. It's all very confused still, but I think that the fact that Guaido still enjoys significant support internationally and that pressure is being brought to bear on the Maduro regime means that, you know, the transitional government may still have a chance to pull this through.
Do you think that Guaido is in danger of being either arrested or possibly worse?
It's a matter of speculation, but one of the things that seem to be going around the news today is that perhaps the fear that he might have been arrested perhaps was the reason that it accelerated the decision to make this plan operational. And it is very likely that the Maduro regime might want to arrest him, or even worse, just to remove what has become the symbol of defiance against the dictatorship. But the continuous support that Guaido gets from the international community, including the numerous foreign embassies still open in Caracas, ensures that the Maduro regime will think twice before actually laying their hands on
him. Right. If Maduro's military starts targeting civilians, the U.S. has basically said they won't stand for that. They said all options are on the table, but can the U.S. really intervene militarily?
Look, I mean, it's not a question of can. Of course, the U.S. can. The question is, well, it's a wise move. And certainly a rapid escalation of violence with innocent blood being spilled and significant number of casualties would create an outcry that may justify a military intervention on the basis of a responsibility to protect. What I would say, though, is that it would be preferable if it were to come to that type of situation that the regional allies of the United States in Latin America, countries like Brazil, countries like Colombia, who have been clearly very vocal in support of Guaido and have been close to the Trump administration in the effort to prop up Guaido and give him legitimacy and support, they should be the one intervening. And the U.S., of course, can provide them with the kind of logistical support, the kind of qualitative edge coming with intelligence, with logistic, with humanitarian aid, that would make an operation successful. But it would be certainly preferable, given the history especially of U.S. intervention in the region, if this is something that could be solved by the local powers.
We heard from Secretary of State Mike Pompeo earlier that Nicolas Maduro was apparently about to get on a plane to leave the country when Russia told him not to or intervened and talked him out of it in some fashion.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously, we don't know how to verify that claim, but the U.S. certainly has good intel and understanding of what is happening on the ground. And I think that highlights part of the reason why, despite the catastrophe that the Maduro regime has been for the country, why Maduro still is in power, and that is that he is basically being propped up by foreign interference. The Russians, the Chinese, the Cubans, of course, who are probably the backbone of the army right now, and the reason why the army is not defecting is the heavy presence of Cuban military and counterintelligence. And so hopefully increased pressure, while there is significant challenge from within the country against the regime, may just do the trick and push Maduro over the edge.
It does sound, from everything you're describing, though, with all these other parties getting involved, that this could get much uglier.
It definitely could, especially if Maduro and those members of the military still loyal to him decide that they're going to use significant violence in order to stay in power. If you start seeing significant casualties and violent clashes across the country, that'll be a game changer, and it may, on the other hand, give the moral and legal ground for military intervention from outside forces.
That's Emanuele Ottolenghi, Senior Fellow with the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. A former Minnesota policeman has been convicted in the fatal shooting of an Australian woman. Two people are dead following a shooting on the campus of the University of North Carolina. The White House and Democrats agree on a price tag for an infrastructure plan. And children are working to survive in the poppy fields of Afghanistan. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The Washington Post is reporting that Special Counsel Robert Mueller, in a letter to Attorney General William Barr, said that his four-page summary of Mueller's Russia report did not fully capture the context, nature, and substance of the investigation's conclusions. Mueller's letter, according to the Post, also said there's public confusion about critical aspects of the investigation's results and that it threatens to undermine a central purpose for the appointment of the special counsel. Joining us to talk more about this is criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. So, Jack, are there legal ramifications of any of this? What do you have to say? What's your reaction?
If we look at what came out after Barr's four-page overview of the Mueller report, it was clear they weren't in sync. And I think if we look at what Bob Mueller's letter, essentially that private letter that has now come out, it really reflects that. And it really reflects the overall intent that Bob Mueller was trying to establish that Barr, for whatever reason, decided to go a different direction with.
This seems pretty unprecedented, almost like the Attorney General of the United States, who was appointed by President Trump, he's drawing his own conclusions, which seem to be consistently supporting the president. After Robert Mueller and his team spent 2 years working on this investigation, I would imagine it would be frustrating for someone who put that kind of effort and energy into a 400-page report.
Yeah, this is particularly disconcerting. This is a 21-month investigation. Thousands of interviews took place, more than 400 pages. And what we're seeing from the Attorney General is that he seems to have forgotten his role. The Attorney General's role here is he is the attorney for the United States. He is not the attorney for the President of the United States. Those are two fundamentally different acts, fundamentally different roles. And what he's doing is he seems to be the President's number one cheerleader when that's not what he's supposed to be.
Another part of the letter, Post quoting Mueller as saying, there's now public confusion about critical aspects of the results of our investigation. This threatens to undermine the central purpose for which the department appointed the special special counsel to assure full public confidence in the outcome of the investigations.
That's maybe the worst part here. The real intent of having this special investigation was so the American people could feel confident in the outcome. The problem that we have right now is that after all of the efforts, what we find was the Attorney General actually tried to change the results, or at least he had a different result than Bob Mueller said he had. And that's a real problem. I mean, that's one of the issues that's going to make the American people, not just Democrats,
right,
but the American people as a whole, look at this issue and say, this is a problem. There's something wrong here. And that's the last thing that Bob Mueller wanted.
Barr's actions, could they potentially get him into legal trouble? And given this position as the top law enforcement in the entire nation, why would they want to hide the actual findings to the public?
No, the one issue that continues to come to mind here is the question of obstruction and what it is that this president and some of his advisors have done. If you add this piece into it, you have the potential of looking at more obstruction, more issues that seem to be hiding the net results of an actual investigation. And I think that's what Bob Mueller is particularly frustrated by. I think he and his team did very good work. I think the problem is that when you try to change the outcome because you don't like the answer, that is a problem. It's not just a problem for the left. It's a problem for everybody.
We have not seen the letter, but this is what the Post is reporting, that Mueller asked Barr to release his summaries from the report, which he had laid out, summaries of each particular issue for the public, that they had actually done the work of summarizing. Will the public ever see that, do you think? What do you think happens next?
It's a wonderful question. We know that the Attorney General is going to appear before the Senate. I'm sure he's going to be called back. And again, that's the fight right now, is whether or not he's going to appear in front of the House. But here's an additional element now that we didn't even discuss previously about what it is that the Attorney General's role actually was, and maybe even what the Attorney General's role thinks he should actually be doing. Because at least at this point, based upon this analysis, it seems to me that the Attorney General has forgotten what his role, his crucial role, actually is.
The Attorney General has already been balking at the format that Congress has planned, which would include attorneys interviewing him in this congressional hearing that he was supposed to be attending this week. He doesn't want that. That, on top of the president blocking any of his current or former staffers from testifying or adhering to congressional subpoenas, and also not giving Congress documents that they have requested. What are the legal ramifications of all of this, and can the president continue to refuse to do all this, and the Attorney General as well?
I don't think so. Congress is an equal partner in government, and their job, a very specific part of their job, is to subpoena people to testify. And you cannot simply decide you're not going to because you don't want to. The president can simply decide that his people won't appear because he doesn't want them to as well. Because this is about something far, far greater. And I think you may start seeing a Congress, and I'm hoping Republicans in the Congress, recognizing that the legislature has an equal role in government. And if they don't exercise that role, this is what we're talking about, where you have the lack of balance in power, and you have a presidency that starts to expand far beyond the intent of the framers.
The whole thing, Jack, is astonishing.
Well, it's astonishing to me because if we look at Attorney General Barr, he has had a distinguished career for more than 30 years in government. And yet, if you look at how he's behaving, what he continues to do to support this president, it seems to really mar that effort. And it's shocking to me that this is how he wants to go out.
All right. Also Tuesday, President Trump, his family, and the Trump Organization filed a lawsuit against Deutsche Bank and Capital One Bank in an attempt to block congressional subpoenas seeking their banking and financial records. The lawsuit by Trump and his sons Eric and Donald Jr. and daughter Ivanka was filed Monday in federal court in New York. Also, two House committees subpoenaed Deutsche Bank and several other financial information institutions earlier this month, as part of investigations into the president's finances. Former Vice President Joe Biden has surged in a lead in the Democratic presidential field, according to new polls released since his formal announcement last week. Biden's taking on President Donald Trump directly in the early stages of his presidential campaign, as we hear from VOA national correspondent Jim Malone.
Joe Biden, the next president of the United States. Former Vice President Joe Biden got a warm reception Monday at his first campaign rally in Pittsburgh. And Biden left no doubt he will target what he says is the divisive presidency of Donald Trump.
We have to let them know who we are. We Democrats and we independents who have the same view have to choose hope over fear, unity over division, and maybe most importantly, truth over lies.
Biden's supporters were out early for the event, including Marsha Williams.
I think Joe Biden's a guy with experience, and I think he's a good guy with an honest heart, and that's really means the most to me.
Donald J. Trump.
President Trump has also been busy on the campaign trail. At a rally in Wisconsin, Trump launched a general barrage against the Democratic Party.
So Democrats are now the party of high taxes, high crime, open borders, late-term abortion, hoaxes, and delusions. The Republican Party is the party for all Americans. That's what it is. It really is. And common sense.
Trump has gone after Biden on Twitter and likes to highlight Biden's age, even though both men are in their 70s.
I am a young, vibrant man. I look at Joe. I don't know about him. I don't know.
Biden is currently leading the field of 20 Democratic contenders, followed by Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Sanders is among those Democrats arguing that the country needs sweeping change.
Our job is not just to win the White House, it is to transform the economy and government of this country.
So far, Biden's Democratic rivals do not appear intimidated by his front-runner status, says Matt Dalek.
The field's much wider open, and you know, Biden, it's just too early for the polls to really mean all that much, other than Biden has good name recognition and there's some affection for him.
Democrats can pick from a rich and diverse field of candidates for 2020 that includes several female contenders as well as minorities. But they're also looking for a strong candidate to take on Trump, says expert Bill Sweeney.
We have the most diverse field in the history of the country, and Democratic voters have a great deal to choose from. The other question that the Democrats are going to be looking at as our candidates get tested in the primaries is this the person who can beat Donald Trump in 2020?
I gotta go.
So far, many Democratic voters asking that question appear to prefer Biden. And analysts say that is the key reason for his surge in the polls. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
When Crown Prince Noruhito later yesterday becomes the 100 later today, I should say, becomes the 126th person to occupy the chrysanthemum throne since 660 BC in Japan, he will be ceremonially armed with the glittering ancient imperial regalia of sword and jewel. And beyond the material trappings accompanying what the Japanese claim to be the world's oldest continuous hereditary monarchy, the new emperor will also inherit the deep and abiding respect that his father, Akihito, who abdicated as emperor on Tuesday, has accumulated over his three-decade reign. Emperor Akihito announced his abdication at a palace ceremony Tuesday in his final address as the nation embraced the end of his reign with hope for a new era. VOA Asia's Ira Melman talks to Annika Culver, Associate Professor of East Asian History at Florida State University. He talks about how Akihito gained so much approval.
I wouldn't exactly call him a people's emperor, but he just seems to have a kind of personality that he has this open curiosity about people he meets. And also, if you trace him from his kind of early years when he was groomed for the imperial position as a child and then a teenager, much of his young adulthood was under the auspices of the U.S. occupation through his Quaker tutor, Elizabeth Vining. So he came into contact with Americans, a variety of people that previous emperors never had contact with. He also endeared himself to the Japanese public by jogging around the Imperial Palace, and it became kind of a ritual to see if you could see him. And this was maybe about 15, 20 years back or so, where he could be seen doing a circuit around the Imperial Palace. I'm not exactly sure the distance, if it's an exact 5K or not, but you know, just the fact that he seemed accessible. Of course, the Imperial Household Agency does a lot of curating of his appearances, and they do a lot of handling. But he generally gives the impression that he's not removed from the people. He just has this kind of happy-go-lucky personality that endears him to other people. And I think that he's had to, right, because of the dark image, especially in terms of the mind of Japan's Asian neighbors, of Emperor Hirohito as being this distant figure perched atop a white horse in a military uniform. That's kind of the iconic image that you have of the Showa emperor. Whereas Akihito, you see him smiling and waving his hand. And that's one of the photos that strikes me as communicating that new vision.
What has led to this abdication?
I think it's a really smart move on behalf of Emperor Akihito that he steps down at a time when he's aging, he's in his early 80s. For him to pass down power to his son, who kind of gives this image of a youthful Japan. Instead of an aging population, we have a hearty and hale Crown Prince Naruhito, now becoming Emperor Naruhito, at a time when Japan is dealing with these issues of aging and also how to kind of reposition itself in the world. Instead of Japan passing, Japan having kind of this active role in global endeavors that still kind of communicate the spreading of peace rather than a more kind of militaristic image, which some of Japan's Asian neighbors have been concerned with Abe's initiatives, possible revision of the constitution, more like reinterpretation to many different degrees. And so Emperor Naruhito's goal, I think, as a not a person with political power, but with important symbolic power, is to show Japan as a responsible global power with the ability to kind of proactively contribute to peace.
Many things you have said about the imperial family reminds me of the British royal family. Is the Japanese imperial family as loved as the British royal family is?
Well, you know, the Brits have their tabloids, and I'm not sure if loved or just interested in. It's fascinating. Like, if you go to Japan, they also have their own tabloids. And, of course, with the imperial family in Japan, there's a little bit more respect than British tabloids extend to, you know, their target, right? And I think it's still kind of part of this mystique of the imperial institution, which harkens back to pre-war and wartime times. Older generations have a huge amount of respect for the imperial institution and the imperial family. I think younger people are more, you know, interested in them as people instead of symbols of an institution. There are interesting parallels, but I think also the connections with England are quite important because of the kind of traditional education of the aristocracy in England.
All right. And by the way, Naruhito's wife and daughter were barred from the abdication ceremony because they're female and a palace tradition the government upheld, despite criticism that it is out of step with modern values. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Ghana on Tuesday launched a life-saving malaria vaccine for children, one of three countries in Africa to do so, and the only one in West Africa. The vaccine is said to be about 40% effective and cost $1 billion to create. Still, experts say other malaria prevention measures are key to the fight. Stacey Knott has more in Cape Coast.
It took more than 30 years and almost $1 billion to develop the malaria vaccine launched in Ghana today. The vaccine, known as RTSS, reduces cases of the mosquito spread disease in children by up to 40%. Ghana, Kenya, and Malawi are participating in a pilot vaccination program, which began last week in Malawi. Over the next 4 years, about 1 million babies are expected to be vaccinated with four doses of RTSS. Cape Coast is a city in one of three regions Ghana is targeting due to high levels of malaria. The vaccine is considered an additional tool in the fight against the disease alongside bed nets and indoor insecticide spraying. The World Health Organization's Richard Mahigo says the vaccine is needed because progress has stalled in recent years.
This is really something we are considering in the public health that I dream coming true. Because so far, when we looked at the intervention that has been used to fight the disease, we believe that this new vaccine is going to add quite a significant boost to the fight against malaria.
The World Health Organization says malaria infected 219 million people in 2017 and killed 435,000. The disease remains one of the world's leading killers, claiming the life of one child every 2 minutes. Most of these deaths are in Africa, and more than 250,000 of them are children. Ghanaian officials launched the vaccination program Tuesday with patients from Ewan Polyclinic in Cape Coast. The clinic serves low-income Ghanaians, many of whom live in cramped conditions and prefer to sleep outside where they are vulnerable to mosquito bites. Since 2016, the clinic had seen over 1,000 cases of malaria each year in children under five. Nurse Agnes Morg-Duncan is hopeful the vaccine will protect children and help eradicate malaria.
Our communities are the main fish have foods. And a lot of people, we have the densely populated area. So sometimes you see maybe a one room and with so many people in one room. And then sometimes they mostly sleep outside before getting to inside. So automatically or definitely they will be bite by the mosquitoes and then you'll be infected with it.
The vaccine will be rolled out in Kenya in the coming weeks, and doctors will watch closely to see if malaria rates decline. Stacey Knott for VOA News, Cape Coast, Ghana.
Organizers of the 50th anniversary event celebrating the iconic American music festival known as Woodstock say the show will go on despite the loss of a major financial partner. Woodstock 50 co-founder Michael Lang said they're committed to ensuring the anniversary is marked with a festival deserving of its iconic name and place in American history and culture. More than 80 artists, including John Fogerty, Miley Cyrus, Santana, Imagine Dragons, Robert Plant, and lots more, are expected to perform on three main stages being held at Watkins Glen International Racetrack in the Finger Lakes region of upstate New York. The original concert was held on a farm in Bethel, New York, that's now being run as an attraction by a local center for the arts. That venue, too, has its own anniversary event planned for August with performances by Ringo Starr, Fogerty, and Santana. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day. And maybe it's the time of us.
This is VOA News. I'm